Rescue me before I sink, lose the ship at sea. We are broadcasting live from the sovereign state of Jefferson, and we will do so every Thursday at 7 p.m. until further notice. I am Drew Lamb, and here with me tonight are my co-hosts, David West and Chuck Horton, and our very special guest, my friend Toby Mullen. Tonight we'll be covering some Fukushima news, police state news, and we'd also like to pay tribute to the legendary Russell Means. So at the moment, let's just jump into some Fukushima news and radiation weather. Right now, my Geiger counter is showing 50 CPMs pre-Fukushima. That would have been about 50 CPMs. So that's reading a bit high right now. Let's take a look at radiationnetwork.com to see what the readings are across the nation. I'm seeing a high reading right now of 70 CPMs near Philadelphia. And if we look over on the West Coast, readings are relatively low right now, 39 on a counter near Coos Bay. That's not too far from where we're at right now. Low counts, I'm seeing 13 down in Austin, 9 CPMs down in South Florida, and 11 CPMs up in northern Maine near the border of Maine in Canada. Since I'm on this website, there was something I wanted to get into. Tim at Radiation Network, I just want to say I really appreciate this site. This is a free site, and he sells Geiger counters. He sells some really good Geiger counters. I actually bought my Radiation Alert Inspector EXP from him, and it's really the best. It reads alpha, beta, and gamma, and you can participate in his network, which I don't. I run Mac. I think I have to have Windows computer and the software and all that stuff, and I'm just not into doing that. But I really appreciate it. But he has some messages up here that he puts up, and there was one recently where he was addressing some high counts. I think it was in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and it was somebody running a PRM 9000, and somebody was getting some unusually high readings, and Tim usually will go through and try to debunk high readings, unusual readings, because there could be other things. There could be rain out, which is often radon, and that can release radiation, and oftentimes you get higher counts after a rainstorm, but you could also get higher counts from fallout after a rainstorm or a snowstorm. And on October 23rd, he had debunked high counts on this Geiger counter and was saying that it was radon washout, and was saying that the guy was probably reading gamma radiation. And he stated that alpha and beta particles don't typically penetrate structures. And I'm not an expert. I'm not a scientist. You know, like I've said over and over again when I've blogged this on Radiation Weather on Facebook, I'm not an expert. I'm just a guy with a Geiger counter. But I have three Geiger counters. And in addition to my Inspector EXP, I have a Victorine CDB 700. And I have a Red X Quattra. The CDB 700 reads both beta particles and gamma rays, and the Red X just reads gamma rays. The Victorines got a shield on the probe. And so if I only want to read gamma, I can just close that probe. I'm only reading gamma. And if I want beta particles, I want a reading on that, I open it up. I always get massively higher readings with the probe open. And it doesn't matter if I'm inside or if I'm outside. And actually, I get relatively the same readings inside or outside. And so from my experience, most of the readings that I've been getting are beta particles. And my RADx only reads gamma rays. So that usually comes in around, you know, somewhere between 8 and 15 microrentgens per hour. And if I've got my probe shield closed on my CDV-700, I'm usually around 15 CPMs or so. So I have to disagree with Tim on this point. And, you know, he's an expert. Maybe he knows something. I don't know. I hope he listens to this, and I hope he elaborates on this, because I just disagree with him. I don't think that this is just a radon, you know, that's typically found naturally after rainstorms or thunderstorms or whatnot. So I'm going to move on after that statement. Another article I wanted to talk about that I saw in Energy News. All 12 earthquakes to hit Japan were near Fukushima Prefecture. This was posted yesterday. So Fukushima was getting pounded with earthquakes yesterday, and they ranged from 3.0 to about 4.5, it looks like here. This is a big deal because, you know, as most of you know, they've been listening to this show regularly, Reactor 4 has a spent fuel pool that is currently just open to the atmosphere. It's got massive amounts of spent fuel stored in there, including the reactor core from Reactor 4. I don't know why you just stick that in a pool of water and stick it 100 feet up in the air, but they did. And then they propped the pool up on stilts, and the building's sunk almost 3 feet so far, and we have earthquakes rattling it. You know, take maybe a 7.0 to knock it down, or maybe less. Now it's not, the building's not sinking evenly. It's sinking asymmetrically, and it could tumble. And somebody posted on one of their web pages. I'm not going to name any names. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but there was a story that was going around that the spent fuel pool had caught fire. There were massive radiation readings in Japan, and really, really scared a lot of people. And I don't know if this was done intentionally or if somebody just got misinformation. I don't know. But it's good to check your sources before you put this information out. I mean, when I heard this, the first thing I did was I checked the JNN cam, and then I checked the TEPCO cam. And I don't really trust the TEPCO cam. You know, they could loop it. They could do things to it to, you know, play old footage or whatever. But it's good to see, check those things out and see what's going on before you jump to conclusions. I would like to point out, however, that this could happen. And so don't just dismiss this. If you hear a report of this, don't just dismiss it and think that it's you know, Chicken Little saying the sky is falling. Check the cams and see what's going on. And before you start throwing the story around, research it, you know, and see what's going on and make up your mind yourself. But it's highly likely that that scenario will come true, you know, that pool could catch on fire, that it could collapse. Gunderson had said that if that caught on fire, it could split Japan in half, and there's been many scientists who believe that this could cause a massive extinction event in the Northern Hemisphere. So enough on that article. There was another one here. I also saw this on Energy News, but this is actually a sharing of a broadcast from John B. Wells' show, Coast to Coast. He's really a great guy. John Wells has been covering Fukushima regularly, and this is a topic that has been shunned by mainstream media. And some of us have made it our mission to keep talking about this. It's really up to alternative media to keep this information out there. And I don't mean to sound all conspiracy theorists or whatnot, but you just have to look at who controls the media and who controls the energy companies. And well, it's General Electric, really. And so that's why it is what it is. And General Electric doesn't own me, and I don't get any money to do this. None of us do. We're just here doing this because we care. So I have nothing to gain from this, and I only wish to share the truth and to help people. So on this show, John Wells was interviewing Don Heckert, who's a U.S. Air Force U-2 pilot. He's retired, and he had done missions where they were investigating nuclear fallout and looking at weather patterns and how radiation travels within the jet stream. And he's pretty hip to the jet stream and the Japanese firebombs or the fugos that Kevin Blanche and I were talking about last week on the show.
Was the World War II bombs?
Yep, the World War II
The
bombs,
ones that
Toby.
landed in Klamath Falls or something?
Yeah, there were a couple that landed in Oregon. And one story says they were trying to start forest fires in Oregon. I don't know if that's the truth. But Heckert commented here. I'm just going to read his statement here. This is strictly as a hunter, fisherman, gatherer, subsistence guy. I'm retired. I go down to dig clams. I've dug clams for years and years and years as an Alaska resident. Normally, I'm allowed to get 40 at a time. I went out twice in 2 months, once in April, once in May, and got two clams one time and three another time, and they were really juvenile. And I called up Fish and Game and said, "Gee, I'm concerned. Something has happened to our clam population on the Kenai Peninsula where we were fishing. That concerned me." A little later, we have numerous reports of our sea life, particularly the larger mammals having lesions and scars, and they can't define why they have these huge sores on them. And I'm not sure that there's a conclusive report on that. Yet that's followed by the major tourist activity of the Kenai Peninsula during the summer is king fishing. World record salmon are pulled out of that river, and it's really an economic boon to that Kenai Peninsula in that local area. They canceled the season this year halfway through because the return didn't come back in the numbers that were required to even sustain the population. And that's really sad. I'd like to note, however, that my friend Todd saw salmon up in Bear Creek near Talon. So apparently we aren't suffering the same plight here. And let's see. Oh, one thing I wanted to talk about here. Sorry, but I remember last year hearing reports from people who were up in Alaska. Complaining about bloody noses and bleeding gums and bleeding out their ears and classic signs of radiation poisoning. And for a while, the jet stream was just blasting heavy on Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. And it very well could have been from Fukushima fallout. And it would be nice if the EPA would do their job and stop covering for the energy industry. And tell us what's really been going on, or we need to defund them and stop charging the taxpayers for this. Another article that came out yesterday, I think this is perhaps the most disturbing. The headline here says, "More U.S. tuna contaminated. Study entire food web, including humans, may be affected as Fukushima radionuclides spread to West Coast." And this was a study that was it was a joint study conducted by the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics, Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon, and NOAA Northwest Fisheries Science Center and the Hatfield Marine Science Center in Newport, College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at OSU in Corvallis. It says here the incident, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant released a substantial radioactive contamination into the environment. With the predominant wind and current flow in this part of the North Pacific, these radionuclides will gradually spread to the U.S. West Coast waters after a suitable period of time, with the possibility of affecting food quality throughout the food web, including humans. In addition to the passive transport by currents and winds, the migratory pathways of large pelagic fish extend from Japan to the Northern California current. These organisms can serve as transport vectors for these nuclides, especially given their capacity to concentrate radionuclides from surrounding waters and prey. We examined the amount of distribution of important radionuclides in the Northern California current ecosystem, from the plankton to larger fish, seabirds, and marine mammals, based on archived and post-exposure organisms. In particular, we focus on albacore tuna as a target species that migrates across the North Pacific Ocean, feeding through its range and commercially important along the U.S. West Coast. By predicting the radiobiologic stress, if any, for a managed species as more Fukushima-related radionuclides are uptaken, and appropriate action may be taken before significant population effects have occurred. Determination of natural background concentrations and high-quality transport models produced from these data also aid in management in the event of future accidental release and in regulating safe activity releases. So, and I think that it has spread to the West Coast. I've mentioned this before. I was talking to Scott Munson from Plant Trees down at Occupy San Francisco. It was almost a year ago, and he was testing kelp in San Francisco Bay, and it was reading above background radiation. I think he was using the same device I was using, that I have a Victory CDV 700. I can't remember. Let's see, Chuck, you had a few comments about Fukushima, I think.
Yeah. last week, Kevin, who was just awesome, he said something, and what he said was true, but if you have to understand it in the context of what he was saying, gamma radiation is perhaps the most dangerous radiation because it's hard to stop. It's, for all practical purposes, you need like about 100 feet of lead to stop it. It'll pass through everything. If you have enough gamma radiation passing through you, it will hit a cell. It'll hit many cells, and it will cause incredible damage. But background radiation, being what it is, and even maybe a one or two times background radiation, not so big of a threat, because we're still quite a bit away from Fukushima. And in science, there's this thing called the inverse square law, which says that as you move away from a source of anything, what you receive in radiation from that, whether it be light or radioactive radiation, is going to diminish in an inverse square relationship, which means like it's, the further you go away, the radiation drops by a square root of the initial radiation. I don't want to get into math, and we don't want everybody to turn off the radio, so we'll just skip the math part of it. But anyway, it still could be a big threat to us if reactor number 4 goes, because there is a lot of spent fuel in that pool, and that would dramatically increase the amount of radiation that's going to be going out in the atmosphere, and that would start to become a real serious problem at that point. So I don't want to say it isn't a problem, but right now, if things stayed as they were, our biggest threat is really from the alpha particles and the beta particles that are coming over and can be absorbed into your body and sit in your body and get taken up into one of your organs and start causing damage there. And it's kind of a slow kill. It'll take maybe 2 or 3 years to kill you with a cancer of some kind. But that's just kind of clarifying what he was saying. What he said was true, but if you don't understand how this stuff works, you might think, oh gosh, we have to run away from the gamma rays. You have to, at a certain concentration of radiation, they're extremely dangerous and they'll fry you.
Well, one thing that I'd like to point out is that they are a sign of fission taking place in the reactors. And before reactor 3 detonated, witnesses stated that they saw what's known as gamma ray fluorescence, and I've seen the same thing on reactor 4. It's been a few months now, but for a while, when you're watching the camera, you just see the reactor at night glowing like the sun. It was just bright like the sun. It wasn't artificial light. I've been watching those cameras for over a year and a half now, and I know what artificial light looks like versus neutron beams and gamma ray fluorescence. And so, definitely if you're close to the site, the gamma rays are a hazard. And if the reactors are fluorescing, it's likely they're gonna detonate, I think, or blow up or whatever they're gonna do. It is a significant sign. But it's just like what I was talking about. Tim's comments on radiation network. If we're getting gamma rays over here, it's probably cosmic radiation or radon. And not from Fukushima. I would agree with you there. But we're getting other stuff. We get alpha particles and beta particles, and that's bad news. And you don't want to be exposed to those, and you don't want to inhale or ingest any emitter. So get ready. I've said this before. Get ready to bug in if that thing blows. Have lots of water, lots of food, 6mm plastic, duct tape, the works, and be ready to seal everything up, turn off your HVAC system, and bug in if that thing blows. We'll have about 4 days to react once we know for certain what happened. And then it's just a matter of taking the readings and knowing when it's the most safe to be outside in it.
Yes, and I would add one thing to this is don't trust what the government tells you. Do your own research. Is that you can't, your life is too important to trust it to the government.
Exactly. I agree. So let's see. Let's move on from that. And one of the topics I wanted to discuss tonight, we've got a lot of material to cover as usual. I wanted to talk about Russell Means. And that was one of the reasons I love hanging out with my friend Toby, but this is one of the reasons why I wanted to invite him onto the show tonight. Toby's been a really good friend of mine since, I think since I was a freshman in high school.
I was going to say it might even go back as far as junior high. But
yeah, it's been, we were locker partners at Medford Mid High, which
that's
doesn't
right.
exist
yep.
anymore.
That's right.
Yeah. Toby's been in film for a long time. He always bring weird stuff that I'd find in our locker. We were locker partners, and I'd find axes in there and strange props. And people were usually freaking out, but it was usually a film prop. Whips.
Yeah.
Things like that. I think, let's see.
Odd things the average sophomore wouldn't be bringing to school.
Yeah, unless you were making a movie about something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And we were both Indiana Jones fans. I think we watched Raiders of the Lost Ark together at the old Holly Theater.
Yeah. Yeah, we did.
And that was fun. Raised a lot of cane. And, one thing Toby's influenced me in that he posts about things that he likes and specifically icons on his Facebook wall. And a while back, he had posted some things about Russell Means, this Native American activist. And that's what really turned me on to Russell Means from the get-go. And then he's been a regular guest. Russell Means has been a regular guest on Alex Jones over the years. But I think Toby was the first person that really exposed me to his ideas. I'd seen him in film and TV and whatnot, but it really didn't resonate with me.
And the irony about this is that Drew, when he asked me to come on, I kind of gave him the caveat that he's got to understand that he may know more about Russell Means than myself. And the irony is because I'm Native American, and not that take this for the nature in which it's intended, not that that means anything, but I think the initial idea for having me come on was to have a Native American point of view, which is understandable. And I guess being Native American, well, here's my point of view, but Also, the what I explained to him was that, not that I'm anything special, but my experience was I was adopted. My dad's a history professor. My mom's an artist. We lived in Africa for several years, and I don't have the reservation life experience that Russell Means does, but I do have, you know, I guess this is a particular point of view. So the irony was that what I was telling Drew was that basically I was raised white middle class, so that's gonna be that's gonna be the point of view you're gonna get. But you know, he went for it anyhow. So so here I am.
Well, Toby and I were actually debating, you know, how we should introduce him, you know, and especially address where he's from. Toby's always told me that he was from the Papago Nation.
Yeah, which Drew researched, but which I knew, was the Spanish interpretation of my nation, which is the Tohono O'odham, from southern Arizona. And they had a lot of agriculture, and the Spaniards came in, and because they were eating a lot of
Tipperary beans.
Yeah. So Papago was actually a Spanish term for bean eaters.
Yeah.
Or bean people.
Yeah.
And then Drew cracked wise and said, so they were calling them beaners even back in the 1500s. So.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah. Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So. So anyways, we wanted to talk about Russell Means and Russell Means the activist and Russell Means the icon. And, you know, Russell Means was an early leader of the American Indian movement. And he led the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota in 1973. And he'd been in some movies and TV shows. He was in the Last of the Mohicans and Natural Born Killers and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And he also was libertarian, and he ran for the libertarian nomination for president in 1988. And I think that Russell Means really embodied libertarianism, but I think he took it much further than that. I think he was really putting it in action more than most people, you know. And in a topic that I want to get into more and more is the topic of agorism, which is taking libertarian concepts and or libertarian theories and actually putting them into action, specifically the economic theories. And this is where Means was really doing something.
Well, he was doing that, though, right? Because he was seeing a government that wasn't providing base. I mean, a nation as a whole is maybe now starting to feel what the Lakota Nation has been feeling for about the last 100-some-odd years, in that the government said, we're going to take care of you, don't you worry. And, you know, You take some photographs over there, and you don't know if you're looking at, you know, somewhere on the other side of the world, or, you know, I mean, there are places there that have, you know, I mean, they still don't have plumbing, you know, running water and electricity.
Life expectancy is in the mid 40s. All sorts of diseases and abuse problems, and they're under government health care. You know, under Obamacare or Romney care, I mean, shouldn't they just be like super healthy and well taken care of? And you know, and some of these residents within the nation of Lakota, they get government checks, and they don't go directly to there. You know, they would they'd go to the local store, and the store would cash them, and then just, you know, take what they wrote and give them the change. And so I think that there were also various treaties that were broken. That was one of Means's complaints. And so Means decided to create the Republic of Lakota and secede, create a nation within the United States. And in a video I think he did in 2009, he was inviting people to come and be citizens of the nation of Lakota and come and start a business.
Well, you know, that's interesting. He was, I mean, I was unaware that he did that until you told me, but I also knew that the part of the Iroquois Nation that exists, that resides on the Canadian side of the North American border, they're actually a sovereign nation also. Mm-hmm. They've done exactly what Russell mm-hmm. enacted, and I don't think they've created their own currency. I think they still operate off Canadian currency, but they've claimed themselves as a sovereign nation, and even went as far as creating their own passports. So,
well, Means was inviting people of like mind to join him in the Republic of Lakota, and he was saying that it was an energy-rich nation. It sounded like he was devoted to clean energy projects, solar energy projects, and was interested in partnering with some of the other energy companies that were out there. And I believe his region included parts of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Montana, and Wyoming. I think that was the region. I don't know the exact...
Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, imagine if you could set up solar farms. That would probably turn that nation around pretty nice,
or,
you know.
Or wind. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he had a plan laid out. But what got me was that he was so bold about this, you know, and it's the same as his occupation of Wounded Knee. You know, he was one of the... early leaders of the
American Indian
movement, and he and others. I've been trying to find out how many people were involved in that occupation at Wounded Knee. It was an armed occupation. They took over the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota.
You know what? There's a you can look it up. Agents of Repression, I think, is what it came out maybe about 20 years ago, but now not that long. But it's a great book. It actually covers the government's influence on the Black Panther movement
mm-hmm.
in Oakland and the Wounded Knee. I'll get it to Drew and he can maybe post it. But if you guys want to read into it a little further, it's a great book. But there was a group of them. I don't remember exactly how many actually participated, but the three main people at the time, I believe, were Russell Means, Dennis Banks, and John Trudell.
And Bill Means.
Bill, yeah.
Yeah. And the way that Russell described 50 caliber fire, I mean, actually exchanged gunfire with government agents and the BIA. And
that was the same incident that landed Leonard Peltier in the Federal Clink
mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm.
they convicted him of killing two FBI agents mm-hmm. on the
right
during one of the conflicts.
Well, yeah, but Bill Means, he tells it differently. He says that that they had captured two guys. They were trying to make their way. They were trying to make their way back to Wounded Knee, and they were going through various roadblocks and whatnot. And they had encountered a few APCs, and I think one of them set off a flare, and so they decided to go into the tree line. And so they were traveling in the tree line, and then they encountered two men that they believed to be Navy SEALs. He thought they were Navy SEALs, and he was former military. I think Bill had gone to Vietnam, and was using his training. And I don't know if he was drafted or if he volunteered. I think that'd be significant to know that. But anyways, they captured these guys. They disarmed them, and they were trying to decide what to do with them. If they were going to take them hostage, kill them, or let them go. So they took their arms and they released them. They let them go. They didn't kill them.
Right.
But there was another murder that took place, or a killing. I don't know if it was self-defense or the details of that. And I think that Russell Means was acquitted.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting because we're talking about the Wounded Knee occupation of 72, I believe it was, but. And if we're talking about Russell, I it's too bad because I actually had to work this evening, probably about 17 years ago, 96, I had the opportunity to meet him. He was interviewed on cable radio in Portland, and but I had to work. But a coworker of mine who conducted the interview actually got me a signed copy of Where White Man Fear to Tread, which was Russell Means. He had history of his family on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, my coke-addicted roommate at the time sold a bunch of my books to pals. And so someone got signed a copy of Where White Man Fear to Tread. But going back to the what you were talking about, the Navy SEALs, and you can take this any way you'd like, but he was his grandmother was at the Battle of Wounded Knee. Mm-hmm. The Battle of the Bighorn.
Oh.
And her account was, I give Richard Mulligan props for playing General Custer, and his whole soliloquy at the end, and I mean that was just a great performance. But the way that's portrayed and the way it's portrayed in art and in the history books is that he was overwhelmed, which he was. But what they don't say is that Russell Means' grandmother said that Custer actually committed suicide because he was so overwhelmed. He saw this as just, we are not getting out of this, and as opposed to going down with the ship,
right,
he blew his brains out.
Ah.
So that's a completely, that's quite a turnaround in, of historical interpretation.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's...
Yeah. Yeah, it's no pride there.
Food for thought.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the things that I appreciated about Russell Means' activism was how he tried to describe to everybody, well, mostly white people, about how what's going on right now with the banksters and the New World Order is that a reservation is being set up for all of us. And he did a video. I posted it on
Welcome to Facebook. Our world, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to the reservation. He spoke out a lot against the banks and the Federal Reserve and their incessant printing of money I was just thinking about this today. It got me. Do you remember that movie Smoke Signals that came out?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great movie.
That was a really cool movie. But I was thinking about that scene. I can't remember that character's name, the guy with the glasses.
Right.
And he was telling the story, what I call the story of the Jesus fry bread.
Yeah.
Where and the story where the woman holds the bread up over her head and there's not enough bread for everybody. And she tears the bread in half and there was enough bread for everybody. And well, that's kind of how the Federal Reserve works. You know, you get a piece of bread, they take your dollar and they tear it in half and there you go. it's kind of the same. And I think that, you know, if you've lived in the system that's been laid out for the American Indians, you know, where they've been given these reservations to live on, or as Means called them, concentration camps. You have a totally different perspective on reality, and most people cannot even begin to appreciate it, but I think they soon will.
Yeah.
I think that the time is near when people will see this for real, and I've gone to FBO.gov and I've seen the request for proposals to build labor camps. They call them responder camps. And it even says in there how they're to be run, and the internees are given priority for work. That's why they're labor camps. And this is real stuff. I've researched it. I've talked about this on Madison Rupert's show, In the Lie. Madison's written many articles about this, and people should check that out. And I think we're using up a lot of time here, and so I want to give the floor over to Chuck and David. Hopefully they're still on here with us. You guys
still here? Before we switch topics, I just wanted to say I was pretty bummed to hear that Russell Means had died just the other day. It was only a couple months ago. I rewatched Last of the Mohicans, which I've owned for a while, and I've seen several times throughout the years, and I've always really enjoyed that movie. And just this last time I watched it, you know, I was reminded of all the sort of libertarian subtext in it. And, you know, there's some pretty explicit parts where the colonists are kind of talking about, you know, how they don't need the government. The government doesn't help them. Make some pretty disparaging remarks against the British and government in general. And so after I actually Googled, like, Last of the Mohicans libertarian, really only trying to see if, you know, anyone else had written any articles about the libertarian themes in the movie. And, of course, the first thing that pops up was actually Russell Means, and it talked about how I think he'd been a libertarian president or a libertarian candidate for president at one point. And I was like, wow, no way, because, you know, he's the main the main Indian character in that movie. He's the dad, Daniel Day-Lewis, and the other guy's dad in that movie. Of course, I guess Daniel Day-Lewis is his adopted son in the movie. But so I thought that was really interesting. So I actually read up a little bit about him. And, I mean, that couldn't have been more than a month and a half, 2 months ago maybe. And so when I heard he died just a couple days ago here, I thought that was pretty unfortunate. He's definitely a pretty unique voice in the liberty movement. But
Dan, I was just going to echo kind of some of what you said. My in doing my research for my probably never to be finished book project, I was reading about the history of the United States before we were a country, and there was a huge war with the Indians in after the French Indian War had been resolved. Other tribes kind of started a rebellion. I think they called it Pontiac's Rebellion. And they were winning. They were just kicking everybody's ass. They were burning down forts. They were really doing, just kind of running the British out of the area. And the British were really just hateful bigots. That's all I can say. The letters that they write home, they just demeaned them as savages or whatever. And yet a lot of the people that were overrun and captured by the Indians brought them into their society, gave them full rights of citizenship in their tribes. When they would, come across these people, the people didn't want to leave the tribes. They wanted to stay there. They were they had more voice in their government and their own lives than they did under the British rule as a colonist, and they wanted to keep it that way. They didn't want it. And it was the British soldiers were stunned. They couldn't understand what was going on. They didn't understand that freedom is really that big of a value that people would turn away from the quote-unquote greatest civilization on earth at the time to live with the Indians.
Well, go ahead, Toby. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, well, that's just it. I mean, and that's how the whole East Coast nations were. At the time, the Iroquois were the greatest nation on the eastern seaboard. And they just kept, they would just move down and not necessarily assimilate other nations, but they would go in, basically kick ass, and then just say, well, now you know what we can do. Go about doing what you were doing before you even showed up. And if anyone comes to try and, violate your territory, well, we're behind you. And if anyone comes up against us, we're you'll be with us. They would conquer, but then they would also be, fair and just. So, no wonder these captured soldiers that were assimilated in the nations were saying, why do I want to go anywhere else?
Well, and I'm wondering too if many of these conflicts were due to how the indigenous nations viewed themselves versus how European settlers viewed themselves and the indigenous nations. You corrected me one night when we were having a discussion. We were drinking beers and watching a band, I think, and you explained to me the difference between a nation and a tribe, and my ancestors were Scottish, and they descended from the Lamont clan or the Lamont tribe, and by no means was that a nation. A nation is a sovereign nation of people, and a tribe is more like a community or a clan, even related people in a way, but it doesn't have the same standing as a nation, and I think that that's significant, and I think that Means made that really clear, in listening to him speak. I think he made that abundantly clear, and you've made that clear to me what that definition is, what that meaning is, and I think that could be a huge problem with how the settlers and even the government, has dealt with the indigenous nations. They don't recognize them as being a nation.
No, they don't. They don't.
So I think I've done a lot of talking tonight. I need to yield the floor.
Well, if we can change gears just a little bit here, I want to give sort of my sort of regular update on the police state. Only the main article I wanted to talk about tonight isn't necessarily the police state. I mean, this was not something done by the government per se, but it was something that was committed by one of its employees. This is an article from Huffington Post. NYPD officer Gilberto Valle was arrested in a plot to kidnap women and cook them. This is pretty horrifying. I actually just shared the link on the Double Crossed Facebook page for anyone who wants to check it out. But basically, this cop, his name is Gilberto. I think it's Valle. It's V-A-L-L-E is his last name. Okay. He was an NYPD officer who was basically caught. I think he'd been turned in by his ex-wife, who knew about some of his sort of fetish chats that he would have online. He was caught illegally compiling a list of 100 women that he wanted to stalk and kidnap and cook and eat like a cannibal. It's one of the more shocking articles I've seen in a long time. Thankfully, it doesn't sound like he was ever able to partake in any of his sick fantasies. It's one of those things that almost makes me hope that he'll, you know, get off on a technicality to be released back in society, because he hasn't actually done anything yet. So disgusting as it is, this should all be covered under free speech. I'm hoping he'll get released and, you know, someone will take care of him. I know if it was my wife or girlfriend or something on that list of 100 women, you better believe I'd, you know, bury this guy in the woods if he's lucky. But I thought it was really interesting. It made me think of an article that Will Grigg, who of course runs the blog Pro Libertate that I cite fairly regularly on here, he did an article back in March. I got it up right now. It was basically about police who are sexual predators, and this was one of the most interesting things. I mean, the whole article is just full of horrifying stories. But this was the most interesting part of it to me. It said, in his memoir, Breaking Rank, A Cop Top's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing, former Seattle police chief Norm Stamper warns that, quote, sexual predation by police officers happens far more often than people in the business are willing to admit. My cautious guess is that about 5% of America's cops are on the prowl for women. In a department the size of Seattle's, that's 63 police officers. In San Diego, where Stamper began his police career, 145. In New York City, 2,000. The average patrol cop makes anywhere from 10 to 20 unsupervised contacts a shift. If he's on the make, chances are a predatory cop will find you, or your wife, your partner, your daughter, your sister, your mother, your friend. It's really interesting to me that, you know, the former police chief of Seattle, this is not an insignificant, you know, I don't think anyone can blow him off as a disgruntled former officer who was fired or whatever. This was the top cop in a large city, a guy who probably had at least a 20 or 30 year career in law enforcement. And he's saying things like this. His cautious guess is that about 5% of America's cops are on the prowl for women. It really makes me wonder, you know, what kind of people, what kind of man especially is attracted to the law enforcement profession. I personally believe quite strongly that sort of all evidence points to law enforcement attracting a far higher percentage of, you know, control freaks and just power thirsty deviants than a lot of people, you know, like to think about. People like to pretend that the cops protect them, obviously. And, you know, probably even more so than the military. I think that, you know, the police force just attracts an incredible amount of sociopaths, control freaks, just violent people. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Control freaks, definitely. I don't know.
It's just interesting. It seems like the kind of person who'd want to do the sort – I mean, there's a lot of things that cops have to do that I think, you know, most people just don't agree with. I know a lot of people who – I know cops who don't agree with some of the things they're supposed to do, but they do them anyway. And that just fascinates me. Like, I don't understand.
There's a great episode of This American Life. And the title of the episode is Right to Remain Silent. And it's about – one is about a guy that gets pissed off at the Apple store and types something. I think he was quoting Taxi Driver, and he was an ex-military. Someone didn't like him, and so they called the police and – the guy, oh, you know, and he smoked marijuana for anxiety. And I guess someone read his Facebook status. And then a few hours later, he gets a knock at the door. And he described it as, these weren't your uniform cops. These were your cops in the flannel shirts and the jeans with the badges hanging around their necks. Cops. He's, you know, he meant, they said, you know, can we come in? And he said, well, what, you know, why? And then when he sort of looked out the door, there were 10 more throughout the hallway, you know, with MP5s. And he's all like, wow. And it was all because they were responding to this quote that he had modified from Taxi Driver about how I'm not sure if it was the one of these days the rain's going to come quote or something. But anyway, they thought he was going to actually go down to the Apple store. But the scarier one is the second half about a guy that was, you know, he joined the force to do good. And it was as if someone had taken the script from The Negotiator and turned it into real life. I mean, it was a creepy, creepy experience to listen to. This guy was recording, you know, basically what was going on in his precinct, and they caught wind of it. And there's an episode. There's a part in it at the end, near the end of the segment, where they show up. Basically, he says, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm home. And, you know, basically they tried to influence him to react violently so that they could, he thought that they were trying to manipulate him so that they would have reason to shoot him so that he would not be able to go public with everything he had gathered. But go listen to it. It's This American Life. It's, you can download it, and it's or maybe I'll post a link to the double cross page.
Sure,
but it's really worth listening to. I mean, I don't know how many NPR fans are listening to this, but it is very.
I doubt there are any. Actually,
I was going to say it hits the core of what David's saying about these power hungry deviants. It's
yeah, and that's not all. That's not everybody. That's not all of them. I have some friends that are police officers, and they're very reasonable people. So that, but there are a few bad apples.
That's true. I mean, there's obviously going to be a lot of guys that are well-meaning. I have a couple friends that are cops, but I think that, you know, people do need to recognize that kind of job will naturally attract either. I mean, we have proof that it either attracts more people who have sociopathic tendencies or whatever you might call it, psychopathic, or that more of the people who end up in a job like that get, you know, sort of corrupted by the power and just can't handle it. I mean, one way or another, there are more people in jobs like that. There are more people in the military, you know, who are like that. There are, God knows, there are more politicians who are sociopaths.
It's if you're a pedophile and you're attracted to Child Protective Services or TSA, those are occupations where you can do what you do with mm-hmm. immunity.
I think we lost Chuck.
No, I'm here. I just
I just trailed off, I guess.
I finished.
Gotcha. But well, it looks like we're almost out of time. Drew, you want to close us off?
Yeah, we're down to, I think, our last minute here. I think this has been a great episode, except that I wanted to hear more from Chuck, and I think he had some more material to lay out on us that I don't think we're going to have time to get into. So we're either going to have to podcast another episode or save it up for the next week.
You guys will have to stay tuned and come back next week to hear all the goodies I have. I have lots of them.
You've been listening to Double Cross Radio, and we'll be seceding again next Thursday, 7 p.m. PST. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Good night, everyone.